Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Rick Moore. Talk about making a difference is how we open up the show. I think this is going to be one of the more interesting hours we have. Making a difference. Jordy Yeager. Every time I have you on the show, we're talking about something that is making a difference. And this one, this is truly making a difference. When I did my homework on this, let's go back. When I first asked you, I regularly write you every 6 months or so to ask, Jordy, what are you working on? You always got something interesting. And you said, yeah, I got something I'm doing. And we set up a date for the show. And I'm always... there's always something happening here, and I just set up the Sunday, put Jordy Yeager down, and moved on. And it wasn't until the week came on that I really started doing my homework, and it blew my mind. So tell folks what you're doing.
We'll do it. Thanks, Rick. I appreciate that. It's always good to be here. I started this project with the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center, and it's called Mapping Seaville. And it is an attempt to take a deep dive into historical records and trace them to our current day lives and outcomes in life, looking at how history has affected us and continues to affect us today. That's kind of the broadest overview that I can probably give, but I'm excited to dive into specifics. It was definitely born out of that desire to address longstanding inequities of how do we, you know, we talk about trying to find solutions to all of these problems and these inequities that we experience today. And as a journalist, as a researcher, as somebody who's really interested in how the past affects us, this was a natural fit of, okay, well, the records will tell that story. And so let's get deep into those records and start to explore what's in them. Because up till now, very few people have done that, and nothing this comprehensive has ever been attempted.
Jordy, I didn't introduce you properly. You are a journalist, and... you go way back to the Sunday morning wake-up call for multiple years now. I think I first had you on. You had written an article on homelessness, correct? Those gentlemen and women who stand at intersections with their signs trying to see if folks will donate money, and you actually spend some time with them. Rather than just writing an article about them, you actually lived some time with them, correct?
Right. No, exactly. And I think Stephen Hitchcock, who is part of TJAC, the Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition of Homelessness, is part of the Haven, is part of that network of people, was also on that show. And so that was a really powerful show for me, just to get that, you know, from the service provider sense, and then also from, like you said, the experience that I had with the men and women who are out there for hours and hours every day. That was really interesting, because it shed light on everything. I think everybody that passes by those men and women, they have an idea or they have a hypothesis about who they are, how they got there. They conjure some sort of story in their head, but, very few of us have the opportunity to go out and actually spend time and talk with them, and interact and engage with what those, what their lives have been like up to this point and how they got there.
Most recently, I think back in the spring, you were here talking about an article you had written about
About Friendship Court. Yeah, that was a long project we did with Charlottesville Tomorrow. And so a team of coders and designers, web designers, worked with myself and then Elliot and Giles over at Charlottesville Tomorrow to craft this story. It took many, many months, and it looked at Friendship Court as being one of the largest subsidized neighborhoods in the downtown area that's slated to be redeveloped. And so you have 150 homes that are now going to have an influx of other homes added to their neighborhood. So it's going to get more dense, more people. And what does that look like? And this process was really unique because they got to actually design it. The residents themselves, they got to be a part and in the driver's seat for the most part of that process, which is totally unheard of here in Charlottesville and in most parts of the country. And so it was a really interesting experience to be a part of that. And then to look at the pluses and the minuses of how does that neighborhood change in 10 years, you know, in 5 years as it's redeveloped? What does that look like? And are there risks of, again, are there risks of history repeating itself, of people getting pushed out either, you know, voluntarily or involuntarily? And so, yeah, so that was, again, a really interesting story. I continue to follow that one as well. I'm in touch with many of the same people who I spoke with for that piece. And kind of keeping pace with that project.
And you've been on for other stories in between, but nothing small ever. And here we are today as we talk about your project at the African American Heritage Center, as we talk about the mapping project. And you've been working on this for what's, I mean, at least a year.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. It's been, I think I first started making trips to the courthouse probably somewhere around January 2018, maybe before that, but really in earnest early 2018. So almost 2 years, maybe a little bit more, but yeah, it started with just that interest in what do these records, these property records that are in the city and the county courthouses. They're these giant books. They're kind of like wizard tomes that, you know, they're probably a couple feet long and several, you know, maybe 2 feet in diameter. And you flip them open and, you know, up until 1903, they're all in cursive. And so they're all in the penmanship of whoever is clerk of the court at the time, and they're preserved. Some of them are so old they have, you know, kind of a protective covering over them, but they're still the originals. You have, you know, hundreds of years old documents in these books, and they tell a story. They tell the story largely of land, of money, of power, of control, of using government, of policy, of who lives where, and how do people dictate and determine who lives where. It's a really fascinating story that, you know, is buried in the minutiae. It's in the details. And so, so that's, yeah, 2 years ago, we started really digging into that. In the summer of 2018, we got a grant through the community area, the Charlottesville Area Community Foundation, CACF, gave myself and the African American Heritage Center part of the Heal Charlottesville grant. So after the summer of hate in 2017, there was a fund of money that helped fund projects in the community that were determined to be pushing that equity model forward of what it looks like to be a more equitable city or equitable community. And so this was one of those grants that we got.
Was there one thing that triggered your interest in this?
I think in as you mentioned in some of those stories that we've talked about before and that I've been a part of doing, they inevitably show and highlight the disparities that exist along racial lines in Charlottesville. And so when you look at most junctures of life, whether it's the education realm, so, you know, looking at in-school suspensions, detentions, or looking at literacy or advanced placement courses, or looking at graduation rates, all of those have racial disparities, meaning that how black students and white students are treated and what the outcomes are for each of those students is very different. And at a certain point, you have to start asking the question, is there something that's being racially targeted or racially centered on in terms of how they're being treated and how they're being affected. And that shows up everywhere, right? Infant mortality, life expectancy, inpatient hospitalization, hypertension, diabetes. It shows up in, of course, the criminal justice system. We've studied that for, as a city, for 3-4 years within juvenile system. We're studying it in adults now. It looks, we see it in the economy too, in the number of black-owned businesses that are awarded contracts. I think we've made strides in the last year or so as a city to improve that, but historically speaking, it's been less than 2%. And looking at also, you know, how it shows up in income and the lack of a living wage for many people, and how it shows up with the ability to create generational wealth, not just, you know, a savings account for yourself, but for your next of kin, for your grandchildren. That shows up in very stark terms, not just in Charlottesville, of course, all throughout the country, but it's been something that I've centered on here in Charlottesville for the bulk of my time, as a journalist. So the past 6 years or 7 years or so. And as I saw that, I started to look at studies that, were coming out of different, you know, Ivy League schools, Harvard, Columbia, that were looking at social mobility and income mobility. So, looking at the ability of somebody who's born into poverty to get out of poverty. What does that actually entail? And it turns out you can actually measure that, that there's a system of metrics and there's enough data that allows you to look at somebody's childhood to adult experience. And what is the greatest likelihood of somebody getting out of poverty, depending on where you live? And so there's this economist named Raj Chetty out of Harvard who studies this very, very intensely. And he measured 2,800 and I think 35 different municipalities all throughout America, similar size, and Charlottesville is one of them. And Charlottesville was ranked out of 2,835, it was ranked 2,700th, meaning that there are 2,699 other cities in America where you have a greater chance of getting out of poverty. And that struck me as being really eye-opening for a couple of reasons. Number one, anecdotally, that was a reality that I was well aware of, that that is the experience of many individuals here. But to see it in the numbers was a whole nother thing, because that gives it a little bit more teeth. It gives it a little bit more ability to dig into what then can you do about it, right? In a way that I think policymakers had been denying or trying to think of, you know, short-term solutions for a lot of these, of how do we start, you know, how do we kind of stem that tide? And so looking at that, I was then led to look at this other thing that Raj Chetty created, which is called the Opportunity Atlas, which looks at basically maps census data that is readily available, but it looks at every life outcome. So all of these things that we just talked about, but it looks at them in proximity to where people live. And so it breaks it apart by census tract and by census block. And so that you can actually see our neighborhoods in Charlottesville. It does this for every city. And in Charlottesville, you can see the difference between a historically black neighborhood and a historically white neighborhood and what life outcomes people in those neighborhoods tend to have, based on census data. And again, that reality we've known anecdotally and through oral histories very, very, very well. But to see that mapped out in kind of a visual form was a whole nother thing. And so that really was the jumping off point for saying, okay, if where you live determines what happens to you in life, then why do we live where we live? Is that really our choice, or has that been predetermined for us? And so that's when we started digging into the property records of like, okay, where are the origin points for these neighborhoods? How did they form? How did they come about? And I think certain people, historians locally, have insights into different neighborhoods, and they're really good at knowing specifically about different parts, but nobody's ever kind of woven them together to take a whole look at, okay, here's how policy was affected about that. Here's how infrastructure was affected. And then here's how the correlatory impacts of life outcomes are affected. And that's really what the Mapping Seaville project is trying to do, is look at not only property, but property in relationship to life experiences.
It's just fascinating. And we're not even really going very far yet in today's conversation with Jordy Yeager. He is a digital humanities fellow at the African American Heritage Center. He's a journalist, and he's working on the Mapping Seaville project, which is what we're going to focus on in our conversation today. It's about 15 minutes after the hour. Jordy, I just, maybe it's stereotypical, but I feel like I have to ask, if you're at the African American Heritage Center. I guess I would have expected an African American to be the digital humanities fellow. It just seems like an African American would have been the person to take on the project, and yet you are not.
That's right. That's right. I'm a white man in his 30s, and it is something that we're very aware of in terms of building capacity, right? So that historically speaking, it's not by accident that public history programs are not funded, especially for African-American institutions, right? Monticello, UVA, these are primarily white institutions that have rather robust public history programs attached to them. That is not, again, by accident. That's by design. And so what does it take to actually support and fund and put intention and attention behind an African-American institution? And that's something I'm very passionate about as somebody who's grown up in Charlottesville, as somebody who's worked very, very closely with a lot of brilliant African-American scholars and researchers and filmmakers and storytellers, that I know the capacity is there. And so how do we make that bridge between the funding and the actual tangible support and the products and the resulting efforts of these men and women in Charlottesville? And I was positioned uniquely working with Dr. Andrea Douglas at the African American Heritage Center to do some of that work, to get that foundational sort of support garnered. And the Mapping Seaville Project, excuse me, is twofold. One is to kind of lay that foundation of bedrock of saying this is a digital humanities work that is being recognized throughout the country as being one of the foremost of its kind. And here it is in Charlottesville. It's being done by the men and women in Charlottesville that aren't attached to the university per se, or are not attached to these primarily white institutions. So that's number one. The other thing is that racism is not created by black people, right? It is created by white people for white people. And so how do I, as a white man, start to address that in a way that is very real in terms of looking at how to undo some of the harm that it's been done? And specifically with this project, looking systemically and structurally. And so looking at it from the perspective of this is something that is perpetuated by white ancestors, right? Not in my generation. I haven't knowingly done any of this, but I contribute to it every single day by getting out of bed, by helping perpetuate these systems that were put into place before you and I were ever born.
We're benefiting from it.
Exactly. And so how do we start to reverse some of that and at the very least stop that? And I think that's going to take a lot of intention on the behalf of white people to do that, because it hasn't up until this point been something that we've actively concentrated on. I think the modus operandi has really been, how do we fix you? You know, you being the other, of non-white. And so instead of saying, how do we fix you? We're saying, how do we fix us? How do we fix, white people, in the sense of not hoarding opportunities, not hoarding power, not hoarding control, and looking at, perhaps mapping in affluence instead of mapping poverty.
Our guest today is a fascinating journalist, Jordy Yeager. I'd love having him on the show. He's also working at the African American Heritage Center. You know what? Let's take a break a minute early and come back. And I want you to tell me and tell everyone else about the mapping project itself, because this is what's going on and how you told us about the magical tomes. But there's actually a computer project going on. I want you to tell everybody about that. All right. So we'll be back. Give us just a momento. And we're back again with our guest today, Jordy Yeager. He's the Digital Humanities Fellow at the African American Heritage Center. He's working on the Mapping Seaville Project. And the description or the definition that I got from that was that you're going back and looking through property deeds for racial wording that prevented future homeowners from selling to people of color. Correct?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's sort of, I think, creating a perpetual loop of segregated housing in the city of Charlottesville. Tell us more.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's there are these clauses that were inserted into deeds in Charlottesville that prohibited their sale or ownership to people who were not white. And so these clauses start to get inserted into property records in 1897 is the earliest we've found so far. We're still going back. The period of time we're looking at is really 1888 when the city incorporates all the way to 1968 when the Fair Housing Act is passed. And in 1888, the county is still very much, you know, the entirety of this area. And so the city incorporates and it actually gets its own records books. And they are written in cursive. And then in 1903, it starts to be typed. And so what we've done is started with the 1903 all the way to 1968. We're taking hundreds of thousands of pages of property records and we're digitizing them. And we're also running them through something called optical character recognition. And what that allows us to do is look for terms, look for specific words. You know, when you hit Control F on a document and you look for a term in a PDF or a Word document, this is exactly essentially what we're doing with these deeds. And we're looking for terms like Caucasian or Negro or Jew or Syrian. These are all terms that are used in restricting who owns or who is allowed to own these properties in Charlottesville. And these are legacy neighborhoods. These are long-standing neighborhoods that we know. So that 1897 covenant in the deed was actually for Locust Grove. So that's right by Martha Jefferson Hospital, all the way from essentially Maplewood Cemetery, all the way over to St. Clair Street, and then north up to the 250 bypass. But this is 1897, keep in mind. So up until now, this is a very rural landscape. It's actually part of a former plantation that the plantation home was on Locust Avenue. And that gets subdivided with the creation of these deeds in 1897 into 140 properties. And each of these properties is then has this deed that has this clause that says no one shall own or occupy this home other than people of Caucasian race. And that's in 1897. So it restricts the sale of a significant portion of property in the city, near the center of Charlottesville, close to the turn of the century. Now, keep in mind, this is happening 1898. The next year is when John Henry James is murdered by a mob of 150 white people near the railroad crossing, railroad station out by Farmington. So this is the landscape. This is kind of the context for which this is put in. 6 years prior to that, in 1892, 1891, excuse me, the Piedmont Industrial Land Improvement Company is founded. And that's a collective of African American real estate owners who say, you know what? White people are restricting how we can buy and what we can buy. So we're going to form our own collective. And again, white banks are not lending to black people and black realtors. And so they create their own bank. They create their own collective shareholding group that then allows for property to be bought in large groupings and individually. And legacy neighborhoods, black neighborhoods are created as well. Rose Hill, Fifeville, Gospel Hill, Vinegar Hill. And at the same time, white neighborhoods are restricting their sale. Black neighborhoods aren't restricting their sales to only black people, right? There's no racial covenants saying that white people cannot own or occupy these homes. And so this racial language starts in 1897, but it doesn't stop until 1968. So that's almost 70 years of this racial restriction. And it just keeps repeating. So 1903, more properties get added onto Locust Grove neighborhood with this language. 1915, Meadowbrook Hills neighborhood, that's over by Barracks Road. You know, some 200 to 300 properties go in with this language. Fry Springs, 1923. Park Plaza goes in 1926. Again and again, you know, every neighborhood that we think of as an old single family home sort of neighborhood has these racial restrictions in it. And we knew that we needed to do this very methodological, almost scientific approach. And so we said, let's grab all of the deeds. And we got 152,000 pages of records from the city. We got 150,000 pages of records from the county, and we ran it through this optical character recognition software. We've got about a third of the deeds run through that software, and we pulled all the ones with restrictions and racial restrictions, and we started to upload them to a website where people can actually review them themselves and start to look at.
Talk about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I looked at that last night. I went to the, you can go to the go to the homepage. I wrote that down, and we'll put that in the podcast, mappingseville.home.blog.
Oh, it's actually just mappingseville.com now.
But is it? Okay.
Yep, it would change.
So mappingseville.com. And you can, there's a big red button up in the upper right corner for volunteer.
Yeah, it says, there's a big red button that says get involved. And if you click that, it'll send you to this website that I mentioned, and it's called Zooniverse. It's used all throughout the world by scientists, by researchers, essentially allowing people, so human beings throughout all of the world, to review images. Sometimes it's in, disaster relief efforts it's used. It's also used in studying flora and fauna in jungles. We're using it to review deeds. And so we present an actual image of a deed on the left side of the screen. And on the right side, we ask you a question about information contained in that deed. So, for instance, the first one is a date. You know, when was this deed written? And there's a little box that you enter, you know, okay, it's September 30th, 1926. And then you click next and you're on to the next question. And so on and so forth.
10 questions.
And you go through the deed sequentially. So, you know, things like who bought it, who sold it, how much was it sold for, all the way through the second to last question is, you know, what is the racial covenant? What is the racial language? So that language that we mentioned earlier. And then the last question is, was there a bank or lending institution involved? And I think that's really key because, Charlottesville was not of significant enough size to, allow for an HOLC, a homeowners loan corporation map, which is largely referred to as a redlining map, because it drew red lines around neighborhoods that were primarily African American and which it, as a company, as a corporation, said, these are not worth investing in. You know, it was actually talking to banks, talking to insurance companies, talking to government, saying these are risky investments, these black neighborhoods. And so these neighborhoods that were redlined were not able to get funding to either repair homes or buy homes or even had a hard time securing, future buyers, right? Because they future buyers could not get loans to buy in those neighborhoods. So they couldn't sell homes. And we know that property ownership is the number one way in America by which generational wealth is actually transferred. And so the government is seen in this case in redlining as limiting that. But we never got a redlining map, but we know that it happened, right? We know anecdotally that black families were denied loans that based on address or based on name or just explicitly based on race, and that this happened. And so this is a way that we can start to tell some of that story. Is through the role of the banks that are outlined in the deeds, right? When you buy a property, if you're not paying entirely in cash, then there is some reference to a lending institution that's giving you a mortgage or a line of credit. And so we now have the capacity to look through thousands and thousands of these records and say, okay, you know, for instance, People's National Bank or, even the University of Virginia is sometimes being used as a lender and or securer of, bonds or of money for properties. And so what is the role of these lending institutions in helping, white versus black families advance? And is it equitable? Is it at the same rate or at the same pace? And I think that's a really interesting question.
All right. So two questions come to mind. First of all, the length of time to do one of these. And secondly, you mentioned that you kind of threw me there at the end as though you are also studying African-American deeds, but earlier you said something. I thought you were only studying deeds that gave covenants about not being sold to African Americans, to Negroes. But then you said something there at the very end about checking out banks that might be actually loaning money to African Americans for home purchases.
Right. So 9 times out of 10, those banks are not lending to African Americans.
Okay.
And that's what we're tracking, right?
Okay.
And, I mean, we're looking at the rate at which they're lending to black families versus white families. But, anecdotally, we've got the experience and the lived reality of banks not lending to black people. And so that's what we imagine that we'll find. We'll see what the data actually turns out. But that's never been studied, is essentially what we're getting at, is like, this is something we're looking at in terms of the rate at which black people are getting loans and access to these funding opportunities, versus in comparison to white people. And so, but that being said, we are very much looking at different trends of property ownership across the board. And so one of the things, as kind of separate from this, but in my role as the Digital Humanities Fellow at the Heritage Center, is working with a local filmmaker and historian, Lorenzo Dickerson, to go through black real estate holdings of you know, tremendous value and also large quantity. And so people like John West, for instance, we've got his legal files. So he was born enslaved in 1850. By the time he reaches 50 years old in 1900, he owns more than 100 properties throughout all of Albemarle County and Charlottesville. He owns half of Afton Mountain. He owns 400 acres in Barbersville, 300 acres in Scottsville. He owns the dairy building downtown, or down on Preston. He owns 4 properties along Main Street. He has 3 barber shops that he runs. He owns properties in Fifeville and all throughout the city. And so this is somebody who we not only don't celebrate nearly enough, but we don't look at the impact that that's made for generational families who live in these neighborhoods, let alone his family. He had a number of kids as well. So things like that, things like Nanny Cox Jackson, who owns a significant amount of property throughout all of Charlottesville. She's the namesake, of course, for Jackson Via Elementary School. And West is the namesake for West Street, West Haven. But what other legacies do they have that we haven't looked at because we haven't had access to these records? And so in relationship to these white restricted neighborhoods, to these racial covenants throughout all of these other neighborhoods, what are black people doing? I think that's a really key part of the story that also does not often get told. I think there's a dominant narrative that's traditionally been leaned on here that black people are very passive, that there's this kind of like quiet acceptance that white people are going to do this to them, when that's not the case, right? There is a very, very rich history of resistance, of fighting, and of a power amassing to the point of political power, to the point of capital, to the point of property. And that's a story that's not told nearly enough, but it is in the documents. And so that's what we're doing, is helping bring that out. And people like another coworker, colleague, and friend of mine, Tanisha Hudson, she just premiered her film last night called The Legacy Unbroken, which takes a look at that African-American life from the experience, from the lived experience, right? And so a lot of this research and documentation sort of work will help augment stories like hers and others that are telling the more lived experience of that.
So my other question was, we were talking about the get involved piece that you can go online to mappingseville.com. And as we talked about before the show, if every person in Charlottesville just did one, the speed with which it would help finish the Mapping Seville project. But how long does it take to do just one of these?
It can vary. You can definitely do it in 5 minutes. It depends on the length of the deed, of course. And so if it's a one-page deed, 5 minutes is more than enough. But and again, like you said, 10 questions. They're all contained within there. Some don't have certain elements, and that's fine too. There's no real strict requirements in terms of format. And so that lets things go a little bit more quickly as well. There are some deeds that stretch 2-3 pages, and those can be a little bit more tedious to go through. I think yesterday, we held a training session for people, and people had the experience of anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes per deed. As we've said, there are thousands and thousands of these. And so the more people doing just one, the better. And hopefully, you know, I've had emails from people as far away as, you know, Harrisonburg or Northern Virginia saying they heard about the project and they want to get involved. And, we created a video tutorial. So, in addition to the training session yesterday, we had 85 people attend that, which was really great. And so we were able to do hands-on training, but it's not necessary. You know, we had coffee, cider, donuts, so that was fun. But we can do this online, too. So there are videos. I think you watched the YouTube video.
I did. I watched the YouTube video, and it's really – I mean, the YouTube video is 5 minutes, I think.
Yep.
It was well done, and it was very easy to follow and understand.
That's great. Yeah.
So, I mean, people who are interested should just go do that. If you don't, not to turn people away from attending a training session, but if that's your personal argument, Mr. or Mrs. Listener, you can go online and do that. And I found it quite informative and easy to follow.
That's great to hear. Because, I think that's the trickiest part is how do you explain the process to somebody that's never encountered it before? And so that's really encouraging to hear. But, yeah, as you said, in Mapping Seville, you just hit get involved and you get sent to this site where you click get started. It's a very large button in the middle of the screen. And at that point, you're taken to your first deed. And it's randomly generated. And you're posed with this first question. It'll probably take, probably the longest one will be the first one because most people have never read a property record like this. Maybe they've read their own property record, but not one from 1926 necessarily. And so there's some jargon. I think we're creating a glossary to go along with it just so people can get a sense for some of these terms that are more obscure and, idiosyncratic. But
my problem was I'd done this as a younger adult. I come from a family who spent some time or who owns a business that does leases and closings and et cetera. So I had been sent back to 1700s doing these in York County, Virginia, and I get caught up in reading them and the history, and I think you use the word minutia of – and I'm so inefficient time-wise, and so I'm looking at the one that I was sent yesterday, and I'm like, oh, wow, I wonder. And so who's checking behind me if I do this incorrectly or I run out of time and can't finish it?
Yeah, that is the beauty of the Zooniverse program. So, because it is such a large international program, it's got all of these fail safes built into it. So it accounts for human error by letting us set how many times we want a single deed to be reviewed by how many different people. And so for this project, we've decided on 5 so that 5 different people have to review the same deed before it gets retired. And then when it gets retired, that's when we on the back end get sent the data that's being inputted by you, the user. And from there, it's reviewed again by human beings. And so it's not just, that's why we don't have to standardize the format is because we've got people on the back end that are actively, reformatting and standardizing that data on the back end. But in doing so, we can read people's comments, that they've inserted about a deed or if there are mistakes, we can definitely spot those and catch those. And the law of averages tends to work in people's favor that if you have 5 people, chances are the majority of them are going to come up with one answer versus, a smaller group who may not know or may get confused or may, accidentally enter some information that's not right.
Again, our guest today is Jordy Yeager. We're talking about the Charlottesville Mapping Project. It's fascinating as we're learning about how deeds in Charlottesville have a perpetual loop of segregated housing and the racial covenants. Let's take a break and come back and learn even more. And here we are back, Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm Rick Moore, talking with my friend and deep, deep, deep story journalist, Jordy Yeager, now the Digital Humanities Fellow at the African American Heritage Center, the current 2-plus-year story project, the Mapping Seville Project. So that's a question that I haven't asked is, when do you think you'll finish?
That's a good question. I don't know is the simple answer. It's got several iterations to it. And so with this current phase, I think we're expecting to have a finalized map towards the end of spring, or perhaps the beginning of spring. We'll see how quickly it moves. But essentially, the first phase will be taking all of the city's racial covenants and starting and mapping them. And creating that base map of what does a segregated landscape in Charlottesville look like in terms of who can own where, and looking specifically from 1888 to 1968. Then the second phase will be looking at the county. And so the county clerk, John Zug, just we entered into a memorandum of understanding around 152,000 pages of property records from the county, which will allow us to map essentially that same time period, but for the county. And that'll be very interesting to see how that map looks in relationship to the city. But that'll be the second phase. And again, we'll need human participation in that as well. In terms of reviewing deeds. Then the next phase will be looking at infrastructure. And so looking at as these neighborhoods get developed, they get properties built on them. Most of them up until this point are, you know, using creek and well water as their main potable water source. And so the city is, like many other cities, are developing their municipal grid, their water, their sewer lines. And each of these neighborhoods has to petition the city to get put on this grid. But we have records of those petitions, and we know in a couple of instances that black neighborhoods are being denied these petitions. So white and black neighborhoods are making these petitions at the same rate, but they're not meeting the same fate. And so we have gone through and started to digitize all of the city council minutes for this time period, you know, from the late 1800s to mid 1900s, and also looking at Board of Aldermen, which was, you know, for a period of time in our city, it was a kind of a ancillary government body. And then all of those have correlatory newspaper articles sometimes that are written about them. And so we've started to track all of that, scanning these records, pulling out these petitions that were made. And there are hundreds every year. But what happens to them? Who makes the petition? What is it for? What happens to it? Was money allocated? How much money was allocated? All of these things are very, you can track this. And what it starts to do is, in addition to all of this information, you also have geographic information of where this is. And so you can start to create a map of here is the evolution of water and sewer lines throughout all of Charlottesville's history. And in doing that, what do you think happens to your home when a water line or a sewer line goes into the neighborhood? Do you think it goes up or down in value? Right? And so this is how you show this correlation between home valuation and appreciation in value and investment from the municipal side, from the civic side. But if that is being explicitly denied, and we know that it is in several instances, and I wouldn't be surprised to see it in more instances, to African-American neighborhoods, then what is that role then in the government taking away wealth from individuals versus helping support the accumulation of wealth to other individuals? And so that's the third phase, is looking at mapping that infrastructure, and it'll be on top of that base map of that racial segregation through covenants. So we'll be able to see where those water lines are going, depending on which race is living in which neighborhood.
How am I looking at these maps? I mean, you're talking about digitizing them. Am I digitizing them, or as someone who sits down to look at it, am I looking at pictures of things being taken of sort of the map that someone drawing architecture things would look at, where I can kind of see through it? Am I tapping it to see the pictures layer on top of one another? Tell me more about what I see as someone sitting in my chair to all the work that's been done.
Definitely. Yeah, no, you hit it. It's essentially there will be switches, little toggle switches, where you can turn on and off certain features so that you can, you know, maneuver through these maps using these different layers as you want. So, for instance, you'll have, you know, a base map of the streets and the names and the parks and all of the, you know, a traditional sort of map of Charlottesville. And on top of that, say you wanted to see what racial restrictions were in the housing neighborhoods in 1910. You would have a switch just for that 10-year period, maybe 1910 to 1920, that you could look at. And then so on and so forth, all the way up till 1968, in a way that allows you to see the evolution of these covenants, how they spread. And if you wanted to isolate individual neighborhoods, you can do just that. If you wanted to toggle on and off, you know, certain banks, let's say People's National Bank, I'll use that as an example again, they invested in certain properties throughout the city. So there will be a toggle switch that you just click, and you'll be able to see all the properties that they invested in and where they were in terms of race, in terms of demographic. So that's exactly right. It'll also live in a physical form at the Heritage Center. So it'll be a giant digital display wall, that you'll be able to interact with. And so you can look for your own property. You can look for properties that you're familiar with that have some resonance with you. You can look at pre-constructed stories and through lines, right? So, you know, to go back to the banks again, what is the story of the banks? You know, it'd be one thing to look at all the properties that People's National Bank invested in, but let's tell the bigger story of how People's National interacted with all of these other banks, and also what the cumulative effect of those investments were. How much those properties are worth today? When did that valuation start to really take off? And then really at the core, what happened to the people who own these homes? You know, how did this affect their lives? Were they able to take a second line of credit out on that home and then send Junior to college? Were they able to rent that home and buy a second home and then use that profit or passive income to pay for a medical expense? Were they able to you know, use the accumulative value to secure a reverse mortgage or some sort of bonded instrument of money to then afford a lawyer if they come into contact with the criminal justice system, right? It affects these other outcomes in life in a way that I think we tend to think of as naturally occurring, when I think records and documents show that this is very, very much intentional. And it's a cumulative effect. It's not a one-off. It happens over time and it happens over generations. But it is a repeated series of intentional actions that has helped get us to this point of being able to say the median wealth for a white family in America is $171,000, according to the Federal Reserve. The median wealth for a black family is $17,000. That's a tenth of the amount. That's not because they have any less ability to get wealth in terms of human capacity. It's because that the ways in which opportunities are made available or not has been intentionally designed. And it's been designed not to benefit one group and to benefit another group. And so how does that show up locally in Charlottesville's records is really how we want people to engage with this. So that'll be an experience that you can engage with at the digital display wall at the Heritage Center. It'll also be something that kids start to learn about at a very early age. So it'll be in classrooms, right? They start to learn about geography in fourth grade here in the public school system. And in that experience, you can teach many things. You can teach GIS, which is a digital way of understanding cartography, right? It's geospatial information systems is what it stands for. And it allows people to make their own maps and to use existing maps to create other layers of maps, right? Say you wanted to map all the ice cream shops in Charlottesville. You could do that, right? But what would it look like if, again, coming back to that instance of John West, he owned all these properties in and around Johnson Elementary School. So what would it look like for fourth graders at Johnson Elementary to then go out and start to map where his properties were? And so then they're not only learning about GIS and this new skill that is going to benefit them for the rest of their lives and careers, no matter what, you know, you don't have to be an engineer. You can be a journalist, or you can use it in a variety of ways. And then couple that with learning local black history that's never really been taught, that's never been inputted into the curriculum in a way that's meaningful. And so that is something I think that we're very much geared towards and focusing on, is how do we weave this outside of just the digital space, outside of just the physical house of the Heritage Center, so that you can engage with this material in a variety of ways. Tours are another way, but that's what we're looking at.
Jordy, you've mentioned several times now how the documents go up to 1968. Is there any interest or future possibility of going past 1968 to see if the racial covenants continue afterwards, even though the Supreme Court says they shouldn't?
Yeah, definitely. And what's interesting is, you know, some of that language is still in deeds today. You know, it's just unconstitutional. So you can't enforce it. No court would uphold it.
But it's just a copy, and let's just copy that one and sign it.
Exactly. It's really hard to remove things from deeds. It turns out, you know, it's not as simple as just delete. There's a process. And as a historian, you know, the racial language is a breadcrumb trail of racism. And so you almost want that in the sense that you can then track it. You can then trace it to its point of origin. You can look at how it's been used. And so you, as a historian, as somebody who's fascinated by records and uses those records, I don't want it removed, but I understand the intent or the desire on property owners to have that, their intentions made clear in the property record. But you raise a great point. 68, Fair Housing Act gets passed. What happens next? And that's where I think the city and the city council and then also the planning commission really is interested in this project because, you know, up until this point, I think our comprehensive historical understanding has been relatively limited. I think that Planning Commissioner Lyle Soley Yates is doing an incredible amount of work of tracing zoning. Of looking how in the 20s and then on through the mid 20th century into the 70s and then today, how has zoning transformed and evolved in the city? And one of the things that you see is that as deeds and zoning kind of progress through the century, you know, from early 1900s to mid 1900s, you see zoning start to take on a lot of the language that used to be in deeds, right? So, setbacks, how close your home is to the road, used to be in deeds, now it's in zoning. For instance, what happens, you know, what you can or can't do to your property, how much, a structure has to be valued at. Used to be in deeds, now it's in zoning. All the way up until 68, when the only thing really of substance is left in the deed is this racist language. And so then what happens when the Fair Housing Act says you can't use that? Where does it go? Does it just dissolve? Does it just go into the ether? Explicitly,
right. Bring my vacuum.
Right. Yeah. And so where that goes, I think other cities who are looking at some of this work and tracing some of this history have seen it evolve into zoning language. So it's not explicitly racist. It's not calling out people by race, but it is using different terminology and language to get the same desired effect. And so really tracing that to current day, I think is going to be very interesting. And so I presented to city council this past Monday, and that went really well. We started to talk about some of that policy implication, and they're starting their comprehensive planning process in the spring. And so that is something that we can certainly make available for the organization that they've contracted with to complete that process. Following that, I think will be a look at the zoning for the city. And so that'll be something that is involved in that process as well.
Again, our guest today is Jordy Yeager. We're talking about the Mapping Seville Project. He is the Digital Humanities Fellow at the African American Heritage Center. You talked about your time in front of Charlottesville City Council, but we haven't talked about your time at the Maupintown Film Festival. You need to go back and tell everybody about Maupintown, because I think Film Festival here tells people the Virginia Film Festival. So tell us about Maupintown.
Sure, absolutely. It was started by Lorenzo Dickerson. He's an amazing storyteller, filmmaker, researcher, historian. And he grew up here as well and has family that stretches many generations back and helped found part of the St. John Rosenwald School out in Keswick area, Cobham area. And he's made a number of films, both about his family's history and also just black history in general, right? He made a film about the Burley Bears, the team of 1958 that was unscored upon and undefeated as a football team at Burley High School. And, you know, he made a film about black education in Albemarle County, Albemarle's black classrooms. So his films cover a wide breadth. And with that, he was submitting to these major film festivals, and not being accepted. And so he said, you know what? Why don't we start our own film festival? And Maupintown was created. It is, grown every single year. This coming year in 2020, it's going to look at, the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. And so really focusing on, maybe even exclusively only women produce films, women direct films, women, you know, all women cast, And so I got a chance. Lorenzo invited me to speak at his festival at talking about this project and what the policy and kind of ripple effect ramifications could be. And it was really amazing. It was a packed house, and I mean, it just draws a great crowd at the African American Heritage Center as well.
But what is Maupin-town?
Maupin-town. So Maupin is Lorenzo's mother's side last name. So Dickerson is his father's side, and Maupin is his mom's side. And so Maupin-town was the kind of the name given for the community of Maupins, the Maupin family that lives out west of town near Ivy. And so that was the name. That's my understanding, is the name that was taken from Maupin-town.
All right. Again, Jordy Yeager, just a minute or so left. You know, I'm always curious, how do you get a grant? I mean, I realize that's an hour show in itself, but you said very early that it made it sound like that one of the things that you were given this job, or you took on this job, was because you hoped that it would help get the grant for the project. But real quick.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's grant writing is a whole skill. It's, I mean, people do devote their whole careers to just grant writing. So it is a time intensive, laborious task that just involves a lot of details and a lot of budget and kind of analysis of what you hope to accomplish, what your goals are, and laying all of that out. You know, there are a number of very, very well-intentioned philanthropy style organizations in Charlottesville. And so really just trying to get those dots connected and make sure that they know that this work is being done and that they can be part of supporting it is really what the fellowship is really in earnest trying to do.
Again, Jordy Yeager here, this Mapping Seaville project, mappingseaville.com, and get involved. Go on. There's 10 questions, correct?
Yes.
And learn how to fill it out. Fill it out. There's five different people who are going to do the same deed before it gets sent in to be looked over one last time. So you can do yours. Take your time to do it. Make sure it gets. Make sure you're doing it right. But you're still going to help.
That's right. Thank you, Rick.
All right, Jordy. I love having you on anytime.
Likewise.
Have a great day.
Thanks.
All right, folks, next week we will have, we'll be talking about the altered states of consciousness. See you then.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Engineering assistance was by Mike Friend. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.